That dose saved my life. I felt guilty about it at first, wondering if they had made the right decision. I asked why. They told me that mine was a life worth saving.
And you think mine is?
I know it.
Why?
You were one of those strangers who came here, risking your life to help us. But most of all, I know it because I know what you're thinking right now. She looked away from him. Right now you want to get out of that bed, walk out into this hospital and start helping people. Her eyes told him he was correct. The world needs people like you, Dr. Watson. It's a difficult choice, but sometimes we have to save the people who can help others. I realized the wisdom of my government's decision when I traveled to the refugee camp, and when I came here. A brush with death changes a person. For good people, it changes them for the better, makes them more thankful, and dedicated to the things that matter. Their recovery will take time. We've been bedridden for days, but it will happen. And when it does, we will welcome your help. Rest for now. Chapter 111. The moon lit their way. The boats were nearly silent, the passengers clad in black, their faces painted in jungle shades of green and brown. The salt-laced wind blew through Peyton's hair, whipping it around when the boat bounced. Desmond sat beside her, eyes forward. On this early summer night in the South Pacific, with the wind on her face, Peyton was at peace. She marveled at the events of the last 2 weeks. Her father had returned, Desmond had returned, and she might be about to lose it all. Avery sat across from her. The blonde woman had stuffed her hair in the helmet and applied the face paint liberally. Her eyes glowed unnaturally, like a predator sitting silently in the jungle, examining its prey, contemplating whether to spring. She looked from Peyton to Desmond and back, saying with her eyes, "So you're together again?" Peyton wanted to kick the woman in the chest, send her over the boat's edge. But they needed her, and Avery would probably just catch Peyton's foot and snap it like a twig anyway. Peyton's father seemed to read the exchange. He also glanced at Desmond and raised his eyebrows. Peyton felt herself turn red. It was so bizarre. All her teenage years squeezed into this moment. Not to be left out, Charlotte eyed Desmond and Peyton. She smiled, apparently delighted at the prospect of her former boyfriend's sister and the orphan she had cared for getting together. The only ones who didn't seem clued into the exchange were the Navy SEALs at the bow and stern. The beach ahead appeared deserted, but Peyton couldn't help but hold her breath as the small vessels crested wave after wave. Their boat came to a crunching halt as sand dragged the bottom. The beach was littered with shells, driftwood, and fallen coconuts. It wasn't a pristine resort beach. It was an untouched land, the way nature had made it and kept it for all these years. Soldiers were waving their arms forward, urging their five passengers out of the boat. Seconds later, Peyton took her first step onto the island. Chapter 112. SEALs and Force Recon operatives hoisted the two boats up and jogged into the lush forest. They hid the vessels under camouflage and led Peyton, Desmond, Avery, William, and Charlotte deeper into the South Pacific Island jungle. The troops formed a ring around the five civilians. They crouched slightly as they crept through the jungle, over coconuts on the ground, with palm trees above and dense tree ferns in every direction. The air was humid, sticky almost. The heat was oppressive, but the breeze off the ocean beat it back every few seconds. To Peyton, the jungle seemed alive, constantly in motion, like a single organism breathing in and out. The dense trees and plants swayed in the wind. Creatures she couldn't identify clicked and called and slithered all around her. The plants were so thick she could barely see 10 feet in front of her. Everyone was on edge. Several times they stopped, crouched, and waited, making sure they were alone in the jungle. Peyton had had basic training in voice procedures for two-way radio communication, and it had come in handy on many of her deployments when interacting with armed forces, police, fire, and aviation personnel. The training had certainly come in handy of late. Peyton's father spoke the first words over the comm, a whisper. "Target 300 yards. The group stopped, and three soldiers departed, moving quickly. When they returned, They motioned for the group to follow. The forest gave way to a cleared area. From a hill in the trees, Peyton made out rows of small houses in a Caribbean style. Clapboard sides, metal roofs, hurricane shutters, and large front porches. A massive canopy hung over the homes, supported by metal poles set in concrete footings. An electric vehicle that reminded her of a golf cart with clear plastic sides zoomed away from one of the houses. A Marine spoke over the comm.
Overwatch, units Bravo and Zulu. We're at location Tango, proceeding.
Bravo, Zulu, Overwatch. Copy that. William and four soldiers departed from the group, made their way to the corner of the settlement, and sat for a moment, working their binoculars. The remaining troops spread out in the forest and took up sniper positions, most lying on their stomachs, peering through the scopes of their rifles, sweeping across the small settlement. On the ship, Peyton's father had insisted on leading the advance recon teams. Colonel Jameson had argued against it, but William had insisted that he had the most first-hand information about the terrain and their adversary. In the ship's infirmary, he had made Peyton wrap up his ankle again, administer cortisone shots, and give him some oral painkillers. He had tucked the pills in his pocket, but hadn't taken one. William and the four soldiers accompanying him darted to the closest home and entered through the back door. The older man brought up the rear. His limp slowed him down some, but Peyton thought he was moving well, considering. She counted down the seconds, but nothing occurred. Minutes passed. Then two soldiers slipped out the back door, ran back into the tree line, and exited farther down by the fourth house from the corner. They entered that house in a similar way. A soldier spoke urgently on the radio.
Zulu leader, request backup at location 2.
Orders then came quickly over the comm. Six team members sprang up, raced along the tree line, and burst out into the second home the troops had entered. Peyton was amazed at their speed. She swallowed. Her father was in the first house. Is he okay? The thought of losing him now terrified her. She only realized it in that moment, when his life was at great risk. Desmond looked at her and nodded slightly, a gesture only she could see, trying to reassure her. Avery crept to the leader of Zulu team and whispered to him, too low for Peyton to hear. The man shook his head and pushed her back, seeming annoyed. She didn't let it go. Seconds later, she rose and barreled down the hill. The man's voice was hard over the comm.
Medusa! Return to rally point.
Avery didn't stop.
Fox team, be advised. Medusa's inbound tier 20.
Zulu leader looked back at Desmond, who just shrugged, letting the man know they'd been dealing with the same thing. Another electric car emerged from the wooded path and parked at a house unoccupied by the soldiers. Two more cars drove to different houses. Along the perimeter, several of the black-clad troops began spreading closer to those houses. Peyton desperately wanted to know what was going on, but she held her tongue and tried to stay calm. A hushed voice came over the comm. A soldier. Wounded, Peyton thought.
Zulu! Bravo teams, move in! Hurry!
Chapter 113. Inside the second home, the blinds were closed. Blood spread across the wide plank hardwood floor. Peyton stopped at the sight, walked slowly around it. The Marines and Navy SEALs moving through barely took notice. They went from room to room calling,
"Clear!"
before re-entering the central hallway. Peyton relaxed when she heard her father's voice in the dining room. She found him standing with Avery and two other soldiers. They'd taken a painting from the wall and had drawn a map of the island and its buildings on the back. William activated the comm and laid out his plan, broadcasting to their forces and to the Boxers Combat Information Center. He and the soldiers had interrogated several of the home's residents and had learned a great deal. The map was an updated view of the island's layout, which had changed some since the 60s. About 200 private security contractors were housed in barracks near the harbor. The island had also been upgraded with significant defensive capabilities, including advanced sonar and radar. The technology likely would have detected the larger amphibious landers long before they reached the beach. They were unsure whether the small boats they'd used to come ashore had been detected, but they were hopeful they'd gone unseen. The detection grid was focused on the harbor side of the island. The most concerning fortifications were the island's surface-to-air and surface-to-sea defenses. The Sishium was capable of fending off attacks from the Boxer's air wing, and it had missiles with sufficient range to reach the ships of the Expeditionary Strike Group. William urged them not to move the vessels back. If the formation of ships was already under surveillance, withdrawing might raise suspicion and launch a search of the island. William had flagged two buildings of interest, a lab complex and an administrative building that housed the island's data center and communications equipment. According to the residents they'd interrogated, neither building was heavily guarded, and the current work shift would be ending within the hour. That would be the best time to infiltrate the buildings. Quickly, they made a plan that struck Peyton as well-conceived. The SEALs and Force Recon troops would make their way to the barracks and defense complex. Their first priority would be disabling the island's radar and missile capabilities. Then they would rig explosives to the troop carriers. The logic was that if the island's infantry units were mobilized to repel a ground assault, they could be neutralized quickly. The plan was efficient and deadly, and perhaps the best they could do with their limited forces. Their search of the homes had turned up an IT administrator named Carl and a senior biomedical engineer named Gretchen. Their shifts were about to start, and they would provide a cover for the infiltration teams. Desmond, William, and Avery would enter the administrative building with Carl, who would tell anyone who asked that they were new consultants who needed access to the database. Charlotte and Peyton would enter the lab complex with Gretchen and search for any information related to the cure. Two Navy SEALs would go with the second team. Each team member had brought along civilian clothes and a disguise for this exact type of infiltration. In the bathroom, Peyton began washing off the face paint. When she looked in the mirror, she saw Desmond standing in the doorway. "Be careful." She stared at him in the mirror.
"You too.
I'll see you on the other side."
"I'll be there."
And she hoped he would too. Chapter 114 Peyton rode in the back of the electric car with Gretchen and Charlotte. The two Navy SEALs sat in the front, both silent, eyes forward, occasionally glancing around for any signs of trouble along the dirt road that wound through the island. The car's tiny lamps barely cut the darkness. Peyton assumed that was to avoid being spotted from above. The roads weren't covered with large canopies. Instead, large trees lined both sides, their massive limbs stretching overhead. Peyton glanced over at Gretchen. The woman was in her mid-40s, fit, with blonde hair and an annoyed expression. Peyton wondered what had happened in the house to convince her to take them into the lab building. She assumed some sort of coercion was involved. Most of all, she wondered how a person with a PhD in biomedical engineering, who seemed rational, would ever cooperate with the Sishium.
"Why did you do it?" she asked.
Gretchen replied without looking Peyton in the eyes. Her accent was German, or perhaps Dutch, Peyton thought.
"I dispute the premise."
Peyton bunched her eyebrows.
"You assume we have acted against humanity's best interest?"
Gretchen looked at Peyton now.
"I assure you, that is not the case. Our actions will save lives. It is you whom I should ask why."
"I think distributing a deadly pathogen is just slightly against the human race's best interest.
Your perspective is myopic.
You've killed millions of people in the last week." Gretchen looked away.
"Something we regret.
Many of the deaths were due to decisions by your government and others. But the end results will be the same. An outcome easily worth the price."
"Which is?"
The Navy SEAL driving interrupted.
"Look alive, ladies!"
The car exited the dirt road and moved onto a heavily wooded promenade with covered walkways, no doubt with camouflage images on top. A large, covered parking area loomed to the left.
"Take any space," Gretchen said.
As they parked, the SEAL in the passenger seat turned and said to her,
"I want to remind you of our arrangement and the consequences of deviating from it."
"I require no reminder."
LED lights on the dome of the canopy lit their way toward the lab complex. They walked in silence as other staffers joined them on the path. Inside, a guard at a desk barely glanced at them. Gretchen led them to an elevator and pressed a button that read B4. At the house, Peyton had considered where to go first. The others had the primary mission, finding the warehouses where the existing cure was housed. But as a backup plan, Peyton's job was to find where the cure was being created and gather any information on its mechanism of action. If the others failed,
and governments around the world were forced to try to manufacture the cure themselves, that information would be critical. Gretchen led them to an office with plate glass windows that looked down on the floor of a vast manufacturing plant. The facility was clearly underground, but it was the machinery that shocked Peyton the most.
What is this?
What you requested.
This is where you manufacture the cure? Impossible.
An amused smile crossed Gretchen's lips.
Again, your premises are incorrect, Dr. Shaw.
Peyton activated her comm.
Something's wrong here.
There was no response.
Desmond? Avery?
She waited.
Dad, come in.
No reply came. Chapter 115. On another lighted path, Desmond and Avery walked in silence. William and Carl were roughly 10 feet ahead of them. At the island bungalow, Desmond had changed clothes, wiped the paint off his face, and donned a wig with brown wavy hair. He wore a mustache that itched constantly. The polo shirt was a size too small, the shorts too big. Avery kept glancing over at him.
What?
He whispered.
Nothing.
Seriously?
She smiled. You look like a 70s porn star. He couldn't help but laugh.
Thanks.
Looked like you were putting the moves on Peyton back at the house.
Desmond studied her a moment, but the young woman wouldn't look at him.
Hey.
She turned toward him.
Before, he said, what was our relationship?
Does it matter?
It matters to me.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure it matters to me anymore.
Before Desmond could say another word, William stopped in the path and whispered for them to be quiet. The administrative building loomed. In the building's lobby, they each swiped their magnetic access cards. Carl swiped his own, and Desmond, William, and Avery used cards they had taken from residents of the bungalows. People they had verified had access to the building in critical areas. The people attached to the access cards looked vaguely similar to each of them in their disguises, but they certainly wouldn't fool anyone who actually knew those residents. Desmond just hoped they could get by the guard at the desk and not be noticed by the staff manning the security cameras. To his relief, the front desk guard barely looked up. In seconds, they were past the lobby, at the elevator bank, and Desmond finally exhaled. The building was 4 stories. Carl led them to the server room on the 2nd floor in the interior. It was expansive, at least 100 feet long and 70 feet wide, and extended to the 2 floors above. The place buzzed with the sound of countless servers. Rows of metal cabinets and cages stretched out. Some enclosures lay open, cords spilling out like the entrails of a mechanical monster that had been gutted by a tech. Some of those techs were in the room. They stood at carts piled high with server parts, worked on laptops, and typed on keyboards below fold-up flat screens that extended from the racks themselves. The room was windowless, lit by fluorescent lights, and cool. Air conditioning blew down on them, an artificial breeze from above. Plastic tiles formed a raised floor in a gridded metal framework, and the space underneath the floor allowed conduits and wiring to reach all areas of the data center. Their feet thumped as they walked across the tiles. The scale of the data center was far beyond what Desmond had expected. What are they doing with this much computing power? At various points, Avery attached a small camera to the end of a row of servers. The cameras had magnetic bases and snapped right onto the metal frames. Carl stopped at a rack and punched in some numbers on a keypad next to a small door. The door opened with a click, and Carl pulled out a laptop. He attached an Ethernet cord to a port on a switch above the servers. His terminal has administrative privileges on the network. He stepped aside, and Avery took his place. She set a tablet next to the laptop and brought up a view of all the security cameras she had placed. Thus far, no one was following them. She typed furiously on the laptop. A second later, the logo for Rook Quantum Sciences appeared.
I'm in.
Chapter 116. Peyton tried the comm again.
Desmond? Dad? Avery?
She waited.
Please respond.
To Gretchen, she said,
why are the radios down?
I have no idea.
Don't lie to me. It's not really my department.
Meaning?
Gretchen sighed. Industrial espionage was one of the biggest risks we faced.
What does that mean?
A humorless smile formed on the woman's lips.
Peyton thought for a moment.
Yes, they would have done anything to prevent anyone from taking information off-site, including blocking electronic transmissions.
The building's shielded, isn't it?
Comms won't work inside.
Gretchen's silence confirmed her theory. If the administrative building was shielded as well, Avery wouldn't be able to upload the location list via the satellite internet link.
She needed to know that. Quickly.
Even more concerning was what Peyton saw below. The massive machines manufacturing the cure.
They were all wrong.
Peyton had toured dozens of facilities that manufactured vaccines, antivirals, and monoclonal antibodies that fought infectious diseases. And they all had one thing in common. They were based on biological material. Most vaccines were simply a form of the actual virus they provided immunity for. The vaccines for measles, mumps, rubella, oral polio, chickenpox, and shingles were weakened forms of the target viruses. The weakened forms reproduced poorly inside the body, allowing the immune system time to study and attack them. The body eventually manufactured antibodies, then committed the formula for those effective antibodies to memory, so that when the real virus appeared, the immune system could neutralize it quickly.
Another set of vaccines worked via a chemical process that inactivated the virus so it couldn't replicate inside the body.
The vaccines for polio, hepatitis A, influenza, and rabies worked that way. Inactivated vaccines had no chance of causing even a mild form of the disease they were inoculating against, making them ideal for anyone with a weakened immune system. Vaccines, however, were mostly ineffective in treating patients already infected with a virus, especially if the pathogen was prone to mutation, as was the case with influenza and HIV. For patients already infected, antivirals were the key. Like vaccines, many antivirals were grown from living matter. Monoclonal antibodies, for example, were predominantly grown in cell cultures that fused myeloma cells with mouse spleen cells that had been immunized with an antigen. Other antivirals were chemical in nature and targeted a virus's protein layer or enzymes. But whether vaccine or antiviral, the bottom line was that all known solutions to fighting a viral outbreak required a manufacturing process with a biological or chemical component. And here, Peyton saw no evidence of that. Was the cure a fake? Were the videos of Paris and Athens staged? Or was the cesium cure something else entirely? And if so, what would distributing it do?
Peyton pulled Charlotte close and whispered, "We need to get out of here and warn the others."
A shot rang out, then three more. The Navy SEALs who had accompanied Charlotte and Peyton spun. Blood spilled onto the white floor. They never even had a chance to draw their weapons. The three men who advanced through the doorway wore security uniforms similar to the one worn by the man at the front desk. They swept the office, then walked over to Peyton and Charlotte and began patting them down. The tall man reached under Peyton's armpits and ran his hands down and over across her chest. She pushed him back, but he grabbed her arms.
"Don't touch her!"
The voice was like a lightning strike. When Peyton saw the face of the person who had spoken, her jaw dropped. It was impossible.
Chapter 117. Desmond stared at the tablet that showed the cameras they had placed throughout the data center. Thus far, there had been no movement except the technicians who walked between the rows and occasionally opened an enclosure to service the equipment inside. Lights blinked throughout the room, flashing green as data packets were exchanged on the network and hard drives served up data. There were blinks of yellow and red when packets collided or hardware failed.
Desmond leaned close to Avery.
"How much longer?"
"Almost there."
From his peripheral vision, Desmond saw movement on the screen. Someone running fast. He stopped, studied the tablet.
No, it was just another technician, rushing to a cabinet to work on a server.
Over the next 60 seconds, the server room filled with more technicians. Two or three entered at a time and broke off from each other, veering to different server enclosures and opening them. The scene bothered Desmond, but he didn't know why. It was off somehow.
"Got it."
Avery pulled a flash drive from the laptop and inserted it into her cell phone, which had a satellite sleeve attached. Desmond continued to study the camera feeds. What's wrong here? Were the men moving too quickly? No, that wasn't it. It was their shoes, boots, all the same. Soldiers' boots. Hey, we've got a problem here. Avery squinted at the phone. I know, it's not connecting. William took Carl by the arm. Why? The man shrugged. Phones are banned in the entire building. We need to get outside. Desmond nodded at the tablet. That's going to be a problem. They were surrounded. The figure who had reprimanded the troops walked closer, never breaking eye contact with Peyton. There was no smile, only a hard stare that Peyton thought said, I'm sorry. The person spoke to Charlotte first. It's nice to see you again, Charlotte. The Australian doctor looked as surprised as Peyton felt. She merely nodded. There were a million questions Peyton wanted to ask. She had no clue where to start. Most of all, she wanted to know why. Why this person she loved so much, this person who meant so much to her, was involved with this. The person stopped just a few feet from Peyton, and with a sharp head motion dismissed Gretchen. The soldiers who had cut down the Navy SEAL and attempted to frisk Peyton departed as well. Hello, darling. Peyton swallowed. Hi, Mom. Chapter 118. Desmond pushed Carl against the wire mesh wall. How many exits are there from this room? Two, the nervous man said. They'll be covered, William said. Desmond knew he was right, but Peyton's father always seemed to be a step ahead. William was already reaching into his bag. He took out three round green cylinders, ran to the end of the row of server racks, and tossed the canisters in different directions. Smoke issued forth as they rolled across the floor. The canisters thumped as they crossed the joints where the tiles fitted together. They sounded like the beat of a drum before the start of a battle. William returned and handed Avery a grenade. Go. You'll have to make your own exit. I'll buy you some time. Before either Desmond or Avery could speak, the man slipped into the smoke. Gunfire began a second later. Bullets ripped through the cages around them. Sparks flew. A dozen electrical explosions and pops went off. Shards of metal and plastic issued from the cages like a lethal mix of confetti. Stay down, Carl! Desmond shouted as he and Avery left the man behind and sprinted away. Overhead, fire suppression nozzles hissed, pumping the room full of gas. Argon, or perhaps nitrogen, to reduce the oxygen level and choke off the fire. Avery ran ahead of Desmond, tossed the grenade at the end of the row, then drew a handgun from inside her waistband and squeezed off two rounds. Desmond had counted to 3 seconds by the time he reached her. Most U.S.-made grenades went off at 4 or 5.5 seconds. He wrapped an arm around Avery's midsection and pulled her behind the metal cage just before the grenade went off, blowing them to the floor, him on top of her. For a moment, all went silent. Then the silence was replaced by ringing. Lights overhead went dark. The constantly blowing air conditioning and fire suppression gas ceased. Debris fell onto the raised floor like heavy raindrops on a metal roof. Avery rolled Desmond off her and stood, gun drawn. She looked left and right, then extended a hand to help Desmond up. He marveled at her. She's unstoppable. His body ached when she pulled him up. Seconds later, they stepped through the opening the grenade had created in the wall of the server room into a corridor lined with offices. Soldiers in body armor stood at both ends of the hall. They dashed across the hall into the closest office, and Desmond ran to the floor-to-ceiling window. They were on the second floor. Desmond estimated about a 15-foot drop. Doable, but it would hurt, and probably break a few things. He raised his gun, fired two rounds into the glass. Are you crazy? Avery snapped. Yes, he is. They turned to find Connor McLean in the doorway. You disappoint me, Avery. Desmond moved in front of the woman, shielding her. He knew Connor wouldn't harm him, and he knew why.
Chapter 119. William crept through the room, peering around the servers, moving as quickly as he dared. It reminded him of playing hide-and-seek as a child in a large library in London, but this game was more deadly. The smoke was thick now. He could see only a few feet in front of him. The aftermath of the explosion had brought calm. He desperately hoped Desmond and Avery were outside the building by now. He had picked off two soldiers advancing on their opening, and that had driven the rest back into the smoke. He moved around another cage, listened, heard nothing except for the scattered debris falling and the pop of electrical circuits blowing. Gas issued from the overhead nozzles in about half the room. If memory served him, he was close to the exit, three rows away. He moved to another row, paused, waited. Then another. He was almost out. He desperately wanted to activate his comms, to tell the Marine and Navy SEAL forces to execute a diversion and for Jameson to move in, but the comms still didn't work. Too late. He heard footsteps behind him. He turned, but the man was already on top of him, knocking him to the ground. Another soldier joined him, and in seconds they had bound William's hands. They raised him roughly to his feet, then walked him out of the server room, through the halls, and onto the elevator. It reminded William of that night in Rio, when the thugs had hauled him out of the taxi and marched him through the favela. He had saved Yuri and Lynn's lives that night. They had been captives of a madman, kept confined in a dirty back room of a shanty house. Now he was the captive. They exited the elevator on the fourth floor and marched him to a room with a piece of equipment that reminded William of an MRI machine, except far larger. "It's true. They've done it," he thought. A voice William knew well came over the speaker. "Scan him and bring him to me. Quickly." The soldiers forced William onto an exam table, unbound his hands, and strapped his arms and legs in. A woman wearing blue-green scrubs walked in and injected something into his shoulder. The soldiers stood back while he lost consciousness. When William opened his eyes, he lay on a couch, his hands once again bound. Through blurred vision that slowly cleared, he took in the room around him. It was a corner office, with floor-to-ceiling windows on two sides that looked out on the island landscape. He stood uneasily and shook his head, trying to clear it. A man rose from behind the desk, walked over and grasped his upper arm. "Here, old friend, have a seat. Relax. Everything will be fine very soon." The man deposited William in a chair in front of the desk. Sitting up helped. When the man's face finally came into focus, William was unsure if he was saved or truly trapped. Yuri stood across from him. Chapter 120. The hurt Peyton felt in that moment nearly overwhelmed her. It was like the pain that night in London, when her mother had taken Andrew, Madison, and her away and told them that their father was dead. It was like the dark chapter of her life she had shared with Desmond. She had felt the same then, alone, confused. But this was worse. Seeing her mother here, apparently in charge, involved in the slaughter of millions, complicit in releasing a pathogen upon a defenseless world, perpetrating an event Peyton had dedicated her life to stopping, it was the ultimate betrayal. Peyton tried but failed to keep the emotion out of her voice. "Mom, how could you do this?" Lynn Shaw glanced away from Peyton. "There's more going on here than you understand. Then explain it. I'm not a little girl anymore." "We don't have time. Explain to me how killing millions of helpless people serves a purpose." "Peyton? And what's the cure? I know it's not a vaccine, and it's not an antiviral. Not like anything in use today." Lynn Shaw exhaled, but remained silent. "What is it, Mom? What does the cure really do? I know you're not growing a virus or biological material down there. It's not a chemical agent. Tell me, please. What are you all planning?" Lynn stepped closer to Peyton. "I'll explain. But right now, we need to go." "No, I'm not going anywhere with you. Not until you tell me why you're doing this." "I'm not doing this. There are two factions within the Sishium. We're at war." The words shocked Peyton and infused her with hope.
She desperately wanted to believe that her mother was innocent.
Prove it. Peyton, she's telling the truth.
All eyes turned to the man who stood in the doorway. He wore a white coat. His hair was short, tinged gray at the temples. To Peyton's shock and joy, her brother Andrew stood there, alive and well. Peyton wanted to cry at the sight of him, to rush to him and hug him. But the words he said next crushed her, shattered her heart. She didn't do it, Peyton. I did. Chapter 121. Time seemed to stand still. With Avery tucked safely behind him, Desmond studied Connor's badly burned face. A gust of wind caught the tall man's long blonde hair, pulling it back like a curtain, revealing more of the mottled flesh. Desmond now knew how Connor had gotten the hideous injuries. At the remains of Desmond's childhood home, he had recalled the full memory of that day in 1983 when his home had burned. That morning when he awoke, he had rushed into the kitchen, where his mother sat in a chair, holding Desmond's infant brother, Connor. The baby was smiling. In fact, Connor always seemed to be smiling or laughing. Their father had often remarked that the boy cried a great deal less than Desmond, and because of that, they might be getting another sibling. Desmond had hoped so. He was as taken with his younger brother as his parents were. But that morning, he had paid the infant no attention at all. He had stuffed his face full of eggs and toast spread with Vegemite and beaten a path out the door. Later that day, when the flames were devouring the home, he had screamed Connor's name before running into the blaze. The desire to get his mother and his baby brother out of the home drove him on as the fire burned his legs and the smoke strangled him until he could go no further. He had failed both of them that day, and that failure had haunted Desmond his entire life. In April of 2003, he had gone to Australia to visit his family's grave, to lay a wreath there on the 20th anniversary of the bushfires. He had expected to see a grave marker for Connor, but there wasn't one. That sparked Desmond's curiosity and hope. He spent weeks in Adelaide tracking down old records. He hired the best private investigator in the country, and the second best. The cost was exorbitant. He paid for endless travel, record requests, and attorney fees for court proceedings when records were withheld. Finally, he learned the truth. Their mother had saved Connor in an act of breathtaking bravery and sacrifice. She had cleared the wood and ashes out of the fireplace and set Connor inside it. She had rolled the refrigerator close and tipped it over to cover the fireplace's opening. The initial search party who found Desmond saw only their mother's burned remains. She had stayed in the house, clearing as much of the flammable material as she could away from the fireplace. But a second group of relief workers searching the area for survivors found Connor badly burned, dehydrated, and malnourished. He was at death's door. They flew him to Adelaide, where he spent months in a pediatric intensive care unit, then the burn unit. Desmond cried when he read the doctor's notes. They had expected the infant to die, but at each turn he had defied the odds. By the time Connor was well enough to leave, Desmond had long since gone to Oklahoma to live with Orville. The doctors called the boy's uncle, but Orville refused to take Connor. Desmond had no doubt that part of the report was true. The roughneck had been in no shape to take Desmond, even at age 5. He couldn't have cared for an infant. Connor was remanded to the foster system. Desmond couldn't imagine what it had been like for Connor growing up, so badly injured, physically and mentally. He imagined the would-be parents touring the facility, gazing upon the young boys and girls they might take home, averting their eyes when they came to Connor. Desmond was surprised to learn that the boy had been placed with adoptive parents in 1995 at the age of 12. The record stopped there. Both McLean parents were deceased by 2003. Connor had dropped out of school at age 17 and was unmarried and lived alone. There was only one thing left for Desmond to do. On an overcast day in June of 2003, he parked outside Connor's apartment building and waited, rehearsing what he would say. That morning, he saw his brother for the first time in 20 years. The sight broke his heart, not with joy, but with sorrow. Connor McLean had long, grungy hair and wore baggy, dirty clothes. Track marks ran down his right arm. He lit a cigarette and set off on foot for his back-breaking job on the docks.
Sitting in the rental car, watching his younger brother, Desmond's life changed.
From that point forward, he dedicated himself to helping Connor turn his life around. He bought a company in Australia and directed the HR department to hire Connor. He subtly found out the young man's strengths and weaknesses and insisted Connor's supervisor challenge him. He watched him grow over the course of a few years. Connor moved out of the rundown apartment and left drugs behind, but he could never chase away the demons inside of him. He was the shell of the person he wanted to be. Desmond knew that feeling all too well. More than anyone else, he understood exactly how his younger brother felt. The night when he revealed to Connor who he truly was, that they were brothers, the two of them hugged and promised to never keep another secret from each other. Desmond told him the full truth then, about the Sishium and the Looking Glass, a device that would change the world and allow both of them to be healed, to start over, to literally rewrite the past if they wanted. He saw what he had hoped to see since the moment Connor had walked out of that rundown apartment. True transformation. Hope. Faith. Belief that a happy life was possible for him. Peyton had been right. Desmond did need someone to save. Helping Connor gave purpose to his life. The Looking Glass took on a whole new meaning for him. It became their project, their obsession. The two brothers, along with Yuri, became the Trinity guiding the project, each with their own component. Desmond oversaw the creation of Rendition, Yuri created Rapture, and Connor completed Rook. And then everything changed. Desmond learned the truth about what Yuri intended to do. He learned about the pandemic, and he was horrified. But Connor wasn't. He insisted that it was the only way. He was willing to do anything for the Looking Glass. Desmond wasn't. In the conference room on the Kentaro Maru, they fought over it, said things they both regretted. A bridge officer opened the door and informed them that an American expedition had found the Beagle, the Sishium research submarine that had conducted advanced research in the early years of the Looking Glass. It was a tomb at the bottom of the ocean that held secrets they wanted to keep buried. Secrets that might compromise everything they were doing. Connor ordered a strike on the American ship. Desmond pleaded for him not to, but it was no use. Connor and Yuri were going forward with the pandemic, and there was nothing Desmond could say to convince them not to. So he created a plan to stop them. Desmond contacted Garen Meyer, an investigative journalist in Berlin, who had unknowingly stumbled upon the Sishium conspiracy. Desmond tried and failed to expose the Sishium before the pandemic began, but Connor and Yuri acted too quickly. Yet Desmond had also created a backup plan, hiding Rendition and erasing his own memories. In doing so, he prevented Connor and Yuri from completing the Looking Glass and ensured they couldn't kill him. He hid clues to himself in the hotel room in Berlin and in the Labyrinth Reality app. His backup plan had led him to Peyton, to William, and now here, to the Isle. Behind him, Avery held the tablet with the list of sites with the cure. If they could transmit the data to Rubicon, the information could save countless lives. Desmond saw the same thing on Connor's face that he had seen there a week ago, in the holding cell on the Kentaro Maru. Hurt. Desmond understood now. His betrayal had wounded Connor in a way the man had never thought possible. Desmond expected Connor to threaten him, but he didn't. His tone was soft, pleading.
Please, Des. End this. We'll forget about it.
You know we can't.
We've won, brother. The world is ours. The Looking Glass will be completed within days. We've done it. The hard part's over. Please, Desmond. Please.
His little brother needed him. In some ways, the fire that had almost claimed Connor's life had never stopped hurting him. But now his pain could end. The Looking Glass could save him. And Desmond alone held the key to the final piece, Rendition. With it, he held the power to heal his brother. Soldiers peeked around the doorframe behind Connor and trained rifles on Desmond and Avery, the red dots moving over their bodies like crawling insects. Avery leaned forward, hiding her head behind Desmond. Her voice was a very nervous whisper.
What are you thinking here, Des? Chapter 122. William watched Yuri pace across the office. The small Russian man dismissed the guards but left William's hands bound. William knew he had to buy time. It was his only chance of escape, and the team's only chance to complete their mission. If he could stall long enough, maybe Desmond and Avery could get out of the building and upload the list to the U.S. government servers. Or maybe Peyton and Charlotte could find something they could use. And if he was really lucky, the Marines would arrive to save them all. In the years William had known Yuri, the smaller man had always been stoic, his face made of stone. William had wondered if that was a result of his growing up in Stalingrad during World War II, where life was a living hell. Day and night, the Nazis had pounded the city to rubble and slaughtered its people, including Yuri's parents and two brothers. But now, in the fourth-floor corner office, William saw a softer, more reflective expression on his old friend's face. He hoped he could use that.
There is still time to stop this, Yuri.
There isn't. We both know it.
It was you, wasn't it? The purge.
Yuri sat on the end of the desk. Yes.
They were our friends, Yuri, and you slaughtered them.
You didn't know them the way I did. You protected them, but you weren't one of them. You weren't a scientist. You never saw some of the things they were working on, or what they were really like. Obsessive, vindictive, ruthless. I knew a long time ago, long before anyone else, that there could be only one looking glass device. The other cells wouldn't have stopped. We would have created a completely new type of warfare. A techno-war. Looking glass projects competing, consuming, resources, pitting nations against each other. It would have ripped the world apart. I saved us. I don't regret that.
Do you regret sending those men to my home to kill me?
Yuri looked away.
Why didn't you finish the job? You found me years later, and I was close to finding you and stopping you.
As he said the words, William realized the truth. Why Yuri couldn't do it back then. The man had killed every one of his friends, except for William. He was his last true friend. Perhaps Yuri had realized that after the purge. I owed you. You saved my life in Rio. I pay my debts.
Yes, you took my son's life.
I did no such thing. A relief beyond words swept over William. It was true. The theory he had harbored for so many years. His only son was alive. His suspicions had grown when he found the old picture in Kazakhstan. It could have belonged to Lynn or Andrew. William didn't know which. But what had happened during the last 25 years? He took his best guess.
Andrew's been your prisoner?
For a time.
And then?
My partner. William shook his head.
Impossible.
You would have been proud of him. He resisted far longer than we expected. His re-education took years. But we broke him, showed him the truth. He found in the looking glass what we all see. A way to fix our broken world. And himself. The bargain we presented was simple. One last pandemic to end them all. An end to disease. And for himself, a world where he has two arms. Where he is just like everyone else. A world where no other boy will have to sit on the sidelines while the others play ball. Where no person is born with a disability. Rage built within William.
You brainwashed him. Chose him to get me out of the way.
Yuri seemed unconcerned by William's anger. And to complete my own work. I'm not as young as I used to be. William strained against the plastic zip ties, causing them to cut into his wrists. A trickle of blood rolled down his hand. He desperately wanted to rush the monster who stood before him, but he maintained his composure. Yuri had one commodity he desperately needed. Information. He considered what Yuri had done, enlisting Andrew, Desmond, and Connor to complete the looking glass. They were all broken, in a way, all completely dedicated to the cause. They were all perfect examples of the type of person who could be radicalized. Made to do terrible things in the name of a brighter future. In a way, they were mirrors of Yuri, William, and Lynn. They had all grown up in a desperate and broken world, had come to the Sishium seeking a balm for their pain, as well as for the pain of the world. William wondered if the cycle would ever be broken. Another question had always bothered him, and Yuri was the only person who could answer it.
the night of the purge. Lynn was tipped off. She left while I was in the air en route to London. She was on a flight to France when I landed. It was you, wasn't it? You told her to get out.
Yuri raised his eyebrows. He was impressed.
Yes. You couldn't kill her either.
I needed her to complete my work.
And she went along?
To a point. Taking Andrew as a hostage helped.
She didn't know, did she? About the pandemic.
Yuri's reaction told him it was true. William pressed on, hoping for more answers.
And Hughes didn't either. That's why he went off the reservation when he found out. Why he contacted me.
A minor setback.
You underestimated his morality. That's how he's different from you.
We're a team for a reason. He lacks the fortitude to do what must be done. I do not. I did those things in Stalingrad. And during the purge. And now.
What's happening now isn't courage, Yuri. It's mass murder. You made the world sick.
The world was already sick. It just didn't know it. I've seen that sickness in a way few have. During the war, you were spared the horror. They evacuated you to the English countryside for tea and playtime. Death and misery were on every doorstep where I grew up. I'm saving future generations from that. Soon our solution will be distributed.
The words struck fear into William. Our solution will be distributed.
The pandemic
was a means to an end.
The cure. It's your true endgame. That's why you started the outbreak in Africa.
Yuri smiled, impressed.
Yes, to show the world what the pathogen was capable of, on a small scale, in a place where people would take notice but not alter their patterns, not cancel flights or their shopping trips.
Yuri paused.
And when that horrific pathogen reached their shores, they would do anything for the cure, including giving up their freedom. Don't pretend like you don't know the true nature of freedom. Who knew about the cure?
Only Andrew and myself.
Yuri had turned his son into a monster.
It's over, William. Whether we release the cure or the government does makes no difference.
What's in the cure?
Yuri was silent.
It's one of the looking glass components, isn't it?
Yes.
Chapter 123. Peyton watched her brother walk closer. She knew instantly that he had changed. The Andrew Shaw she had known was a kind-hearted person, dedicated to helping people. Now his face was hard, almost possessed. What's happened to him? Her heart broke at seeing her brother, her hero, in such a state, involved in this. He looked her in the eyes and spoke without emotion.
She's right, Peyton. There's more going on here than you realize. I'll explain everything to you.
You'll never explain this to me.
Don't judge the method until you know the reason. This is a pandemic to end all others. The final pandemic. The world will be safe soon. It's a small price to pay.
At that moment, Andrew saw Charlotte. The sight of her took him aback. His voice changed, softened.
What are you doing here?
Charlotte swallowed. Peyton and Dismond came to my relief camp in Australia looking for answers.
Andrew looked concerned now. You shouldn't be here.
What have you done, Andrew?
What had to be done.
You sent me the supplies, didn't you?
He nodded.
It was you I was writing to. You were writing back all those years.
Charlotte's voice cracked.
I never forgot about you. Or stopped caring.
Andrew stood still for a moment. Peyton could see a struggle within him.
I knew your work was important to you, he said. I wanted to see you happy.
Charlotte stepped closer to him.
If you still do, you'll stop whatever's happening here.
The looking glass.
Can't be worth what you've done.
Andrew took a step back, as if withdrawing from the pull the woman was exerting on him.
None of you understand,
he stared at Peyton.
The looking glass is the only hope for all of us.
Chapter 124. The smoke from the server room drifted through the hole in the wall, through the corridor, and snaked into the office, its wisps wrapping around Desmond, Connor, and Avery, like a preternatural demon trying to wrench their souls from their bodies. The wind pulled the smoke through the room,
around Desmond and Avery and past them, out the broken windows. Connor held his arms out to block the soldiers stepping forward on each side of him. His eyes locked on his older brother, the man who had rescued him from an impoverished, drug-addled life and given him purpose and hope. Now Desmond threatened to take it all away, as if it had been a prize dangled before him only to be ripped away.
"Please, dears, don't do this. Just give me the tablet Avery's holding. I promise I won't harm her."
When Desmond said nothing, Connor's voice hardened.
"You promised me, brother. You swore we'd finish this together."
Desmond exhaled. The smoke was slowly filling the room, clouding his vision, the wind losing the battle to suck it away completely. On the way to the island, he had thought he saw things so clearly. He hesitated now. In Dadaab, he had seen the evil the Sishium had unleashed upon the world. Hordes of helpless people dying, bodies being tossed upon bonfires, orphans who would grow up never knowing love, just like him. Even if the Looking Glass offered a panacea for humanity's problems, Desmond would never ask the world's people to pay that price, much less force it on them against their will. He looked Connor in the eye.
"I'm going to help you, brother. I mean that. Do you believe me?"
Connor nodded.
"Yes, good."
Desmond turned his head quickly and whispered to Avery.
"Go, do it now."
She didn't need to be told twice. She spun on her heel, crouched to make herself a smaller target, and dove out the window as the room erupted in gunfire. Chapter 125. The thick brush below the building broke Avery's fall, but the landing from the 15-foot drop was still agonizing. She groaned, rolled, and fought to catch her breath. Bullets ripped through the tree canopy and raked across the ground just inches from her. She pushed up and ran. Her left leg screamed in pain, but she didn't stop. She activated her mic.
"Overwatch! Medusa, our cover is blown. Request immediate backup, air support, and exfil. Bravo, Zulu, Medusa. Any hell you could unleash would be greatly appreciated."
Seconds later, explosions rocked the island. A fire rose from the harbor. In a thick clump of trees, Avery slumped to the ground, got the sat phone out, connected it to the tablet, and began the upload. After only a moment, the screen flashed, "Upload complete." She activated the North Star app, which initialized a voiceover IP phone connection. David Ward's voice came on the line.
"We just saw the upload."
Avery was still breathing hard.
"What happens now?"
"Leave that to us. Just get out of there in one piece."
Bullets ripped into the tree trunk at her back and across the dense ferns around her. She rolled, pulled the handgun from her holster, and emptied the magazine. She saw three soldiers fall. There were at least 10 more behind them. She slid her last magazine in and began limping away. They were gaining on her, moving slower now, taking their time, hiding behind the palm trees that swayed in the wind. The smoke issuing from the window descended into the jungle and streaked across the glowing moon above. The darkness aided her retreat, but it wasn't enough. Her time was short. Explosions lit up the night sky above her. Missiles from the Expeditionary Strike Group being intercepted by a missile defense system on the island. It was breathtaking. Some of the world's most advanced weapons of war fighting a duel over this placid island in the South Pacific. The strike group was winning. Their missiles began reaching the ground, which shook with every impact. Avery hoped the soldiers would desist in the face of the air power, but they kept coming, closing in. She slid behind a tree and caught her breath. She was cornered. There was only one thing left to do.
"Overwatch, Medusa, request tactical strike against hostiles near my location."
The CIC responded immediately.
"Medusa, Overwatch, negative. Hostiles are too close."
"Do it or I'm dead, Overwatch."
A barrage of bullets ripped into the tree trunk beside her. Splinters sprayed across her left side as she dove to the ground. In the air, she saw a flash. A missile launch from a drone. A second later, it landed at the feet of the soldiers, annihilating them. The ground below Avery erupted. She could feel the heat. For a split second, it felt as if she were in the grasp of a hurricane. The blast tossed her through the forest. A tree trunk broke her fall. but she didn't get up this time. Her limp body lay there as burned debris fell on her, burying her. Chapter 126. In the office above, Desmond rushed the troops who had fired at Avery. He leaped, colliding with Connor and one of the men. A fist connected with his face. He nearly blacked out from the impact. They pulled him to the ground and kicked him in his already injured ribs. He gasped for breath, but a knee landed on his chest, crushed him, suffocated him. The last thing he saw was the butt of a rifle coming down and connecting with his forehead. Yuri eyed William. "Who did you bring with you, William?" William stood silently, his hands still bound. "Surely you didn't bring your daughter here? That would be very dangerous." Yuri studied him. "Then again, you were never afraid to push all in, especially when the stakes were high." He paused. "You did, didn't you? Where is she?" William didn't answer. "She's not in the building," Yuri said. "We would have seen her on the cameras." Realization dawned on him. "But we don't have cameras in the labs. The risk of espionage is too great. She's there, isn't she?" When William said nothing, Yuri snatched the handheld radio off the desk. "Major Reeves, Pachenko, send a unit to the labs right now. Secure Rapture access control. You're also to apprehend Pe-" William jumped up and rushed forward. His sprained ankle protested, but he closed the distance between him and Yuri. His hands were still bound behind his back, but he threw his head forward, connecting with his captors. He had to stop the man, to give Peyton and Charlotte a chance of escape. Yuri slammed into the wall, William the floor. Yuri was out cold. William got to his feet just as the office door flew open and two guards rushed in, assault rifles raised. They fired as William desperately tried to lunge behind the desk. In the Situation Room at the White House, the recently sworn-in President of the United States watched Chinook helicopters lifting off from air bases across the country. Drone footage showed BioShield reserve troops raiding the locations Rubicon had provided. Every single one of them had held doses of the cure so far. Those doses would be distributed within minutes. The UK, Germany, Australia, China, Russia, and Canada had also confirmed dozens of cesium sites. They had done it. The United States would survive. But the president couldn't help wondering what the nation he loved so much would look like in the aftermath of the pandemic. The lab complex shook when the first blast went off. Ceiling tiles dropped to the floor. Glass cabinets rattled. Vials fell and broke. "We need to get out of here," Lynn said. Peyton shook her head. "No, I'm not leaving until I get some answers." Charlotte matched her tone. "Neither am I,"